TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Daniel Ellsberg, The Doomsday Machine. Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. In 1969, Daniel Ellsberg secretly copied the plans for the United States-Vietnam relations, later to be published as the Pentagon Papers. What was not known widely until late 2017 is that Ellsberg also copied the top-secret plans for nuclear war that he consulted on for the Department of Defense and drafted for Secretary Robert McNamara. Some of these papers, along with his first-person report of the history of nuclear war planning, have now finally been published to high acclaim under the title The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. The publication comes at an extraordinarily auspicious and dangerous time, as nuclear tensions are mounting and the U.S. president is challenging North Korea. When the new Ellsberg book appeared in print in late 2017, a related event took place in Oslo, Norway. ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, received the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize. ICAN was honored in recognition of their efforts, quote, to draw attention to the catastrophic humanitarian consequences of any use of nuclear weapons, end quote. ICAN is a coalition of non-governmental organizations in 100 countries. They're promoting the implementation of the United Nations Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty. This landmark global agreement was voted on in New York City on July 7, 2017. It will enter into legal force once 50 nations have signed and ratified it. This new international agreement places nuclear weapons on the same legal footing as other weapons of mass destruction, which have long been outlawed. Two women accepted the award for ICAN, Executive Director Beatrice Finn and Setsuko Thurlow, a survivor of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima in 1945. Here's a short clip with Beatrice Finn.
Nobel laureate William Faulkner said when accepting his prize in 1950, there is only the question of, when will I be blown up? But since then, this universal fear has given way to something even more dangerous, denial. Gone is the fear of Armageddon in an instant. Gone is the equilibrium between two blocks that was used as a justification for deterrence. Gone are the fallout shelters. But one thing remains, the thousands upon thousands of nuclear warheads that filled us up with that fear. The risk of nuclear weapons use is even greater today than at the end of the Cold War. But unlike the Cold War, today we face many more nuclear armed states, terrorists, cyber warfare. All of this makes us less safe. As the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear Wars, the first ever anti-nuclear weapons organization to win this prize, said on this stage in 1985, "We physicians protest the outrage of holding entire world hostage. We protest the moral obscenity that each of us is being continuously targeted for extinction." And those words ring true still today. We must reclaim the freedom to not live our lives as hostages to imminent destruction. Man, not woman, made nuclear weapons to control others, but instead we are controlled by them.
That was Beatrice Finn, Executive Director of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN. said Suko Thurlow survived the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima in 1945 as a 13-year-old child.
Today, I want you to feel in this hall the presence of all those who perished in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I want you to feel above and around a great cloud of 250,000 souls. Each person had a name. Each person was loved by someone. Let us ensure that their deaths were not in vain. I was just 13 years old girl when the United States dropped the first atomic bomb on my city of Hiroshima. I remember that morning vividly. At 8:15, I saw a blinding bluish-white flash. I remember having the sensation of floating in the air. When I regained the consciousness in the total darkness and silence, I found myself pinned under the collapsed building. I knew I was faced with death. I began hearing faint voices of my classmates around me. Mother, help me. God, help me. Then all of a sudden, somebody shook my left shoulder from behind. The man saying, "Don't give up, keep pushing, keep kicking." You see the sun ray coming through that opening. Crawl toward it as quickly as possible. As I crawled out, the rubble was on fire. Most of my classmates in the same building were burnt alive. I saw all around me utter unrecognizable, unimaginable devastation. Procession of ghostly figures shuffled by. Wounded people, they were bleeding, burned, blackened, and swollen. Parts of their bodies were missing. Flesh and skin hung from their bones. Some with their own eyeballs hanging in their hands. Some with their bellies burst open, their intestines hanging out. The foul stench of burnt human flesh filled the air. Thus, with one bomb, my beloved city was obliterated.
That was Setsuko Thurlow. She now lives in Canada and has worked for decades as a social worker in Toronto, serving Japanese-speaking immigrants. Daniel Ellsberg is currently on tour for his most recent book, The Doomsday Machine. Even though the book is in large measure a memoir, Ellsberg is always being asked questions about the nuclear threats of the day, North Korea, and President Trump's public announcements about fire, fury, and total destruction. Ellsberg spoke at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco on December 12, 2017. He was being interviewed by Dr. Gloria Duffy, president and CEO of the club.
Tell us about 1961, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Bob Comer, showed you a graph about the expected casualties from a nuclear war.
I drafted a question that was sent to the Joint Chiefs by my friend Bob Comer, who was the assistant to McGeorge Bundy, was the deputy to McGeorge Bundy, as assistant to the president for national security, in the name of the president, Kennedy. And the question was, which I had the impression they didn't have an answer to and would be embarrassed by not knowing the answer. The question was, if your plans were carried out as planned, and that meant, first, initiating not a preventive war, we've always ruled that out, not a Pearl Harbor out of the blue where there's no expectation that they're about to attack us. That was ruled out by Eisenhower and everybody else. But an initiation of strategic strikes against the homeland of the Soviet Union. In the case, say, of a crisis arising in Europe, Berlin crisis, 1961, or in 58, under Eisenhower. Or if the Soviets went into Iran. Actually, Eisenhower believed, plausibly, that any fighting with Soviet troops would escalate, and escalate to nuclear war. Better that we do it first, you know, and do what we could to wipe out their forces. So there was no plan for limited war with the Soviet Union. And there was another peculiarity of the plans under Eisenhower. In the case of any conflict with the Soviet Union anywhere, whether it was Iran, Berlin, an uprising in East Europe, which is always a possibility, we would hit not only every city in Russia and the USSR, but every city in China. Now, there was a Sino-Soviet bloc, supposedly, there was in the 50s, but it had been, as you know, eroding very much in the late 50s, and by 61, 60, it was really quite a split. But only some people in the government were prepared to recognize that at that point. And the plans called for hitting the entire Sino-Soviet bloc under any circumstances of armed conflict with Russians anywhere. Okay. So the question then was, if your plans against the Sino-Soviet bloc are carried out under any circumstances, how many will be killed? And the answer came, well, you asked me about a graph. The answer came in two parts, in a way. First was a chart, a very simple chart, which I reproduce in the book, very simple to remember, unforgettable, I'm sorry to say, of vertical axis, millions of deaths. And on the horizontal axis, months with fallout, as the months proceeded and the fallout is spread, how many will die? And there was a simple line, obviously a simple linear model. And the lowest number, which was given to the president right away, top secret, eyes only for the president, and I was seeing it because I'd written the question, so Comer showed it to me. The lowest number was 275 million people, going up to 325 million, my question had been, I should say, in the USSR and China alone. My reaction was, this is the most evil plan that has ever existed. It's insane. How could this be the case? And it was not a hypothetical construct of some sort, a model for thinking about that we used to do at RAND. This was the operational plan for the United States forces in the year of a Berlin crisis. They did know the answer, it turned out. So I said, okay, how many altogether then? Not just USSR and China. And within a week, we got a table with the rest of it. Another 100 million in East Europe, the satellite countries, the prisoner countries, we called them. 100 million of them would be killed. Another 100 million in West Europe, our allies, subject to Khrushchev by medium-range missiles, short-range missiles that we could not find or locate. There was no chance, hundreds of them. Just as North Korea holds South Korea total hostage, we can't eliminate that by any attack, and Japan as well, okay? Okay, our allies would be annihilated then by fallout from our own attack. Not counting the Russian attack, which was certain to kill them, but the fallout from our attacks without a single warhead landing over there would kill them depending on which, quote, which way the wind blew, depended on season and the weather. A third 100 million, roughly, in areas contiguous to the Soviet Union and China. Afghanistan, a place I hardly knew, I couldn't have located on a map then, but Austria, Finland. We would wipe out Finland without a single warhead landing on Finland by fallout from our attacks on the submarine pens at Leningrad. Japan, northern India, so forth, another 100 million, all those. A total of 600 million. Hard to imagine, hard to visualize, but 100 holocausts. And even if this was retaliation, which it wasn't, it was a first strike, astoundingly. But even as retaliation, you're talking not about retaliatory genocide, you're talking about retaliatory multi-genocide. And although at that time, the Russians were believed to have hundreds of missiles, more than we could find, oddly, the Joint Chiefs that summer told Kennedy that if we had to go first over Berlin, they thought they could tell him that at most there would be 10 million deaths in the United States only. And that's, I discussed that in the book. That seemed a very odd estimate, you know, because how could it be that low? But the fact that those deaths would be over there, as Senator Lindsey Graham is telling us now about North Korea and war with North Korea, here's Senator Lindsey Graham say, President Trump has said to me face to face, and I agree with him, the casualties if we attack North Korea will be over there. That's a direct quote. Thousands of deaths, yes, our allies in South Korea, but not over here. Well, it's the same calculation, and Kim Jong-un thinks I have to have an ICBM to make this more obvious that the casualties will be over here as well. But strictly speaking, he doesn't need an ICBM. He's got boats, and they don't get here in 30 minutes. But they get here in less than 30 days, and he has lots of warheads he can put on a boat and send to Long Beach Harbor or San Francisco and blow up this. And Rand Corporation, our old corporation, made a study of this in 2006, the year that North Korea first exploded a weapon. And they said 65,000 dead immediately, but 250,000 more dead with radioactivity. In a little while. So Graham would be wrong. You know, nobody's perfect. He'd make a mistake. They're not all over there. But the casualties that are over there would be not numbered in hundreds of millions, but millions in a day or a week. And the human species has never seen violence that big, that fast, ever. It would be more violence in a day or a week than in human history. It's mad, it's crazy that the world is standing by passively and allowing this to be risked and gambled and asked, will he or won't he? We're all watching to see, you know, what will happen when a disaster is being prepared. And that's what I was looking at in 61 that you talk about, but on a scale of 1,000 times greater. We're talking of billions of people, not millions. And that has been true ever since when it comes to war with Russia. By the way, it isn't only Americans. The Russians this week are playing games in Iraq, close to our planes. They're going the wrong side of the Euphrates and interfering with our planes, trying to say, yes, we are, you know, you can't fool with us. And so forth. So once again, we're finding a games of chicken going on, as during the Cuban Missile Crisis, that with Russia threaten, as I say, not millions, but billions. And one thing I think that people are rightly worried about in the case of North Korea, but they haven't defined it just like this, as you know from my book, I've said Trump is not the first to be making nuclear threats. In fact, he's not even the first to make nuclear threats against Korea. The first was when I was 19 in 1950. I was waiting to go to Korea at that point. Harry Truman made those threats in 1950. But North Korea didn't have nuclear weapons then. No president has made a threat of nuclear weapons against the nuclear weapon state for 55 years. That was the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, where the scale was much greater. But we haven't had a threat like this against a nuclear weapons state ever since. It's crazy for either side to think of armed conflict with the other. But both sides are threatening crazy action, and anyone who says there's no chance that that'll be carried out has not been following any of the events here. So we are in a very serious situation.
So the elements of our nuclear policy and strategy are relatively similar to what they were 50 years ago. Where should we go from here? Deterrence, arms control, etc. What's the hope now?
I've never felt that there was no merit whatever, on the contrary, to the notion of deterrence in the sense of having a capability to retaliate to a nuclear attack with nuclear weapons. Granted, we started out in the late 40s as a monopolist of nuclear weapons. We weren't deterring nuclear attack. We were the only ones who could commit a nuclear attack. And then when the Russians acquired that capability, we continued to defend Europe, supposedly, by a willingness to attack first, which meant a willingness to not blow the world up, because we didn't know about nuclear winter then that threatens the entire world. We haven't really talked about that. But a third of the population of the world, 1 billion people being killed by the Joint Chiefs estimate at a time when the world population was 3 billion. That was in 1961. So they didn't know about the nuclear winter, but they knew that they were threatening one third, and they were willing to risk that and even prepared to carry it out. That was never justified. It was never necessary. It has never been in any remote way justified. And it's true, you can't uninvent nuclear weapons, but you can dismantle doomsday machines that we now know would kill everybody or kill a third. By the way, India and Pakistan alone can cause starvation by their attacks with their much, much smaller forces of a third of the world's population. Now, the population of 7 billion. They have no right to risk that over Kashmir or any other purpose. How could they possibly have a right to have such a capability? Ours is 100 times greater and not justified. So, as former Defense Secretary Perry has laid out an agenda, eliminating the ICBMs, the land-based vulnerable missiles, which really are for nothing other than first strike or preemptive strike, because they can't survive an enemy first strike. They're only good if you get them off the ground, use them or lose them. Those should not exist on either side, but we would be safer if we just got rid of ours right away, eliminate the so-called land-based leg. No first use? Yes. It should not be on the table in our bargaining. That doesn't mean that that threat can't work. But in order to make it credible, we build weapons that can end life on Earth, essentially. We don't need that. We shouldn't have that, and so forth. So it isn't enough just to declare no first use, which would be an enormous change in our policy, but by itself would not necessarily affect much. But we should get rid of the weapons for first use. We should demonstrate we have no intention of doing this. Get rid of the weapons in Europe, as Germany has wanted to do for over 20 years. Or I don't say they do at this moment because of the various crises coming up, but really Germany back in the 90s was calling for no first use, and Madeleine Albright said, no way, the U.S. doesn't go along with that. But the people who right now are saying, no, we want first use threats, are the Poles, on now part of NATO, on the border of Russia. Now, they even want our weapons based in Poland, which so far we have kept up with our agreement not to do that. That could change under Trump. I wouldn't be surprised. Or they want their own nuclear weapons, if not ours. What is the threat they're making? Do they want to be occupied? Of course not. But if they use those weapons, what they're threatening is triggering omnicide. And they're not the first to do that. That's the NATO. That's the old NATO threat. But it was never justified. It should not be made. Same for the Baltics. We should cut down the number, in my opinion, this would be controversial, of the sub-launched missiles and submarines. We don't need 14. We don't need 10 Trident submarines out there. They are invulnerable. But we have hundreds of missiles that threaten their land-based missiles and encourage them to launch on warning, on a false thing. That makes the world vulnerable. I would say no country has the right to have the capability to commit omnicide. Cut that down. And is that possible? Well, politically, not this year. Not with this Congress, not with this president. And frankly, not with the last Congress and not with the last president either, or any of them. It would take a new set of standards, mm-hmm. a new norm in a way that you should not have the ability to destroy life. It seems a modest goal in some sense, and yet an enormous change.
That was Daniel Ellsberg, interviewed by Dr. Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco on December 12, 2017. Ellsberg spoke about his new book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. In 1961, he consulted for the Department of Defense and the White House and drafted Secretary Robert McNamara's plans for nuclear war. And of course, he is the author of the Pentagon Papers. The former high-level defense analyst, Daniel Ellsberg, revered this shocking first-hand account of America's nuclear war program in the 1960s. From the remotest air bases in the Pacific Command to the secret plans for general nuclear war under Eisenhower. If executed, these plans would have caused the near extinction of humanity. Ellsberg shows that the legacy of this most dangerous arms buildup in the history of civilization and its proposed renewal under the Trump administration threatens our very survival. No other insider with high-level access has written so candidly on the nuclear strategy of the late Eisenhower and early Kennedy years. And nothing has fundamentally changed since that era. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.